What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Don't forget the current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
And we welcome you in to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. The Legal Eagles are not exactly in the studio. Rich Lankoff is on assignment. Rich, where are you again? We forgot. We couldn't locate you this morning.
At the West Coast branch of Legal Face-Off today.
He took the Bryce Downey Lankoff private jet out to the West Coast for some seminar today.
So Jason's in the studio, Rich is out west, and we've got a handful of guests. We've got the Legal Grab Bag at the end. As always, on Facebook and Twitter, you can also find Legal Face-Off on iTunes. And we have somebody that Rich knows very well from Bryce Downey and Lankoff, an attorney. And the official title, I've been told, is Legal Face-Off Employment Law Correspondent. Maytal Savin is in studio with us. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Rich, there's a story out of the north of the Northeast where there's a women-only Uber set to open in Boston, and you think that's illegal.
So, yes. I don't know if it is or isn't illegal. That's what Maytal is going to help us out with. But there's a company called Chariot, as you referenced. It is billing itself as the first rideshare company for women. The question is, to Maytal, is this legal?
Sure. So there are a number of legal issues. The first question is it legal to only hire women? Another issue is whether it's legal to only serve women. I'm here really to talk about the employment law issues, so we'll get right into that. As many of you know, Title VII is the federal piece of legislation that prohibits discrimination based on a number of different protected classes, one of them being sex. So at first blush, you look at this and you think, okay, this is something that discriminates against women and is therefore illegal. But there's an exception that needs to be considered. And I'm sure that these businesses catering to women only are looking very closely at this exception. And that's the bona fide occupational qualification exception. And basically what that means is that you have to be able to argue that the discrimination is reasonably necessary to the normal operation of a particular business, and there's no reasonable alternative to discrimination. So the courts generally only allow this type of exception to flow when it's very narrowly tailored. So companies are going to succeed when they are able to point to concrete facts that substantiate a business necessity for discrimination. When they point to generalities, they're most likely going to lose. And in this case, the argument is that catering to women only and having women only drivers is a safety precaution and will help women feel more comfortable. Unfortunately, the issue with that is you're going to be dealing with a slippery slope, and potentially it could create a platform for targeting women either as drivers or passengers. Another issue, as we've seen with the Uber litigation, is whether this employment discrimination issue even applies, because these Uber or these drivers may not be employees. They might be independent contractors, and we're still waiting for the courts to rule on whether they are independent contractors or employees. Another wrinkle is...
Let's jump in. The founder of the company... that he calls, again, the female-only Uber, called Chariot for Women. Michael Pelletz is the name of the founder. He says he got the inspiration from Pretty Woman, from the Julia Roberts movie that I know Sam has seen about 100 times.
So he's been holding it for the last 25 years.
Yeah, exactly. It's only 25 years in the making. He said, I saw something in this movie, he told the Washington Post. I was made to take care of women, to love them, respect them. I was meant to do this. And he says, and he was a driver for Uber for 9 months, he said that it shocked me all. He says, it shocked me all the stories of women just getting hit on all the time. Remember, Uber is no stranger to sexual assault allegations. Last month, BuzzFeed said the company saw 170 claims of sexual assault that reported through its customer service database. We've heard some prominent stories about Uber drivers without criminal histories, by the way, who have been involved in, there was a racially motivated choking incident. There was an anti-gay assault. There was a drunken driving arrest by an Uber driver at the Super Bowl. One of them was charged with rape. Contrast with all this is that 19% of Uber drivers in the United States are women. So Pellitz, the founder, says that this is legal. He says, I have an amazing lawyer and law team, and they would never come on board if they thought anything I was doing was illegal. His general counsel issued a statement, again, defending this company and saying that at stake here is more than just privacy. Safety and security are also at issue. Courts have long held that hiring on the basis of sex is permissible where sex is a bona fide occupational qualification in the context of serving privacy interests, which is consistent with what you told us, Maytel.
Certainly.
So you think this will hold up the first time that an Uber driver sues this company because it's discriminating against males?
Well, you know, certainly this is an issue of first impression. We've seen cases in the past, for example, with home health care workers, and the court has upheld this type of discrimination on the notion of privacy and safety. And it's going to really come down to the numbers here. You cited a number of cases of sexual assault, which certainly would help this company defend any employment discrimination cases. However, you also mentioned a number of cases involving harassment and assault based on sexual orientation and other factors. So that cuts against discriminating based on gender alone and might undercut the entire exception entirely.
I imagine that once this app is up and running, which they say is going to be delayed by 5 months now, the first instance where a man goes to sign up for it, like you sign up for an Uber account, is going to provoke some sort of a discrimination case, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that would be the only time, or that would be the initial point with it. And is that enough as a basis then to file a lawsuit against Chariot for Women just because you couldn't sign up for an app?
Well, when you're talking about signing up for an app, you're talking about signing up to be an employee, right?
Yeah.
And right there, any job applicant is entitled to protections of Title VII, which prohibits employment discrimination, and they would certainly have the right to bring a claim. They would start in the EEOC, potentially at the state administrative agency, and then they would probably end up in federal court. A lot of this will be dependent on what turns out with the Uber litigation as far as whether these drivers are independent contractors or employees.
And let's take this to the next level since it's in the news a lot right now. What about transgender? What if there's a biological female who's a transgender man who wants to sign up for it and claims that they're a female, but they're really a man?
And that's an issue that's hot off the press, as we've heard in North Carolina this week, this past month, and a number of other cases. It's going to depend on how the courts shake out. Title VII does not specifically protect gender identity, but there are some recent cases that have been brought but not yet decided that suggest that gender identity is protected under Title VII. And if that is held out by the courts, then certainly a transgender individual would also have a claim for discrimination that they could succeed on in this case.
Maytel Savins with us in studio, Bryce Downey and Lenkov attorney and Legal Faceoff employment law correspondent. I can only imagine the possible lawsuits and all the red tape that Chariot's going to face trying to get this thing moving. How much of an uphill battle is it that they can actually become a solidly working company?
So,
is this going to happen? Is Chariot going to be a real deal, or are they going to get caught up in all this red tape and all these lawsuits that's going to come?
Well, I would imagine that they would, just like all the other ride-sharing companies, be up in business, and they would, you know, have a number of lawsuits brought against them, and it's going to be up to the courts to determine whether this is something that really hinges on safety and is a sufficient exception to the employment laws out there, or whether it's not.
Well, I mean, they're getting some good publicity out of it because none of us would be talking about probably this company without, you know, this legal issue. But, you know, it sort of reminds me, I mean, a lot of these lawsuits, as we all know, and as you've heard me say many times on Legal Face-Off, are just stupid. It's ridiculous. It's the reason why, you know, there's so many ridiculous lawsuits. But it reminds me of the Hooters case, right? A few years ago, there was a guy in Texas who sued Hooters for refusing to hire men as servers. He said that this was a discriminatory policy because he was a male. Listen, it's called Hooters, buddy.
Well, I know Rich is going to be shocked that I partially agree with him, but I think in a free market capitalistic society, you kind of let the app survive. If it can survive on its own, just catering to women. I mean, Uber's available for men. I don't really, you know, see why. I mean, Uber's highly successful, and Uber drivers make a lot of money. So, surprisingly, Rich, I'm going to side with you on this and say that the free market decide.
Well, it's interesting because this morning
Hooters settled that. They settled that case. Hooters argued that, you know, this fell under the bona fide occupational qualification defense that we're talking about here. That, listen, some businesses, just because they're geared towards women or geared towards men, like Hooters or Chariot, doesn't mean it's discriminatory, right? I mean, I think it's a ridiculous legal theory.
And that's why there is that exception, the bona fide occupational qualification exception. Takes the business realities into account. But interestingly enough, this morning in my Uber ride over to the studio, I had a female Uber driver, and I asked her thoughts on the issue, and she thought that this type of app would limit the scope of her business, and she was not interested in being an employee for this type of company. So it will be interesting to see whether this app will survive from a business perspective.
Quick question before we let you go, Mytel. If Chariots for Women were open, would you have used that instead of Uber this morning?
Probably not. I would probably go with whatever was closest available and least expensive. But if it were the middle of the night, if I were somewhere more remote, possibly.
Yeah.
The answer for Whiteside is regardless of
always use Chariots for Women.
Regardless of the wait time, it could be Chariot could have like a 15-time surge price.
Yeah.
And he'd be all over.
I'd tap that pink button for sure.
That being said, though, if I signed up for Chariot, I would demand a damn Chariot to pick me up. I want grapes. I want feathers. I want all of this. This is
Sam wants like an 88 Cutlass with gold rims.
Listen, I got a great idea. You've heard it here first on Legal Face Off. I think we should merge Chariot with Tinder. You know, have some kind of hybrid where
Surrender.
You can actually pick. You could pick your Uber driver.
Yeah, you know, I think that would do a lot to go with the company policy of trying to protect women.
Good point.
All right. Mytel, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Mytel Savin, Bryce Donnie-Lenkoff, and the official correspondent for Employment Law on LFO.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
And we welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN+. Handful of guests today, and we roll right along with Professor Kit Johnson from Oklahoma University, Associate Professor of Law, and she joins us now to talk about some immigration policy here on WGN+. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning, Professor Johnson. Tell us about the Supreme Court argument on Monday and why it's significant, please.
So on Monday, the Supreme Court is going to hear oral arguments in the case United States versus Texas. And this case comes out of the November 2014 memos issued by Department of Homeland Secretary Jay Johnson, where he set forth new policies regarding deferred action for folks who had come to the United States as young people, what we call DACA, and for parents of Americans and parents of lawful permanent residents, which we call DAPA. Texas responded to that. The state of Texas responded to those memos by suing the United States, seeking an injunction against that action, and they were joined by 27 other states. And so what the Supreme Court is going to talk about on Monday, or hear argument about on Monday, is the validity of the arguments raised by Texas and the validity of the ability of Texas to even bring this suit in the first place.
That's called standing, right?
Right.
And it turns on whether Texas's claim that it would be required to subsidize the cost of licenses to people qualifying for the plan, which is called the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, that would provide work authorizations, as you mentioned, and temporary reprieve on deportation to illegal immigrants. I mean, is this really a method by the states to circumvent the Obama immigration policy?
I think there's no question that that's what it is. And I think that the Texas Attorney General himself has made that point. I mean, he has said, Paxton has said, you know, we can talk about standing, but that's not the issue. It's whether the president can change the law. And that, so I think it really is about whether the states have an opportunity to challenge federal law that they disagree with.
So they're not
federal
so Texas
policy,
is,
I should say.
Right. So Texas is not even making any bones about it that, you know, this is a state issue. They are admitting that they are trying to circumvent federal law, and this case will really turn on whether they can do that. I mean, the Justice Department is arguing that Texas has, you know, no business being in court at all, and if these kind of restrictions were imposed, then states could force disputes over a wide range of federal policies. Is that right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly, you've described it perfectly. The idea is we only let people into federal court if they claim a concrete injury. And the question is whether Texas really has the kind of injury that makes it, and the fancy word is justiciable, right? If this is the kind of case that federal courts can hear.
All right, Professor Johnson, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in November upheld Texas's challenge to this deferred deportation plan. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but can you at least give us some insight if that's going to, you know, weigh in on the Supreme Court's decision? And how often is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit overturned or affirmed with the Supreme Court?
I actually don't know the answer to that last question about how often the Fifth Circuit's overturned. In terms of a crystal ball, obviously I don't have one, but there are multiple ways in which the government could win. And I think standing is a strong one because standing is merely about civil procedure, the way civil cases proceed through court. And it is an important question. It's not to say it's not an important question. Standing matters. Who gets to bring actions in federal court? But that kind of an issue bypasses the other issues raised by this challenge, which are sort of immigration policy generally and separation of powers issues, whether when the president issued this power or through the secretary issued this policy statement that amounted to writing law, which he's not supposed to do. He's supposed to enforce law. And that's a tricky separation of powers question. You know, Congress writes law, the executive enforces it. When does enforcing go too far and become lawmaking? Those are big questions that I'm sure the Supreme Court has no desire to wade in on.
Professor Johnson, we've covered extensively on this show the Merrick Garland prospective nomination and the current makeup of the Supreme Court, which, of course, in the wake of Justice Scalia's death, is now made up of 8 justices. We have seen a couple of cases already result in a deadlock 4-4 tie. How do you think all of that impacts this case?
Of course it matters. Of course it matters. And I think that that is a reason why the standing issue might appeal, because I think we could get a majority of justices who will agree that Texas shouldn't be in federal court at all. And I think that gives an opinion that shows the court as not being deadlocked, as being able to reach a decision and one that they would all agree with.
And of course, if there is a 4-4 tie, that means that the lower court's decision remains and that this issue will likely roll into the next presidency, right, before there is another justice who is nominated that might break the 4-4 tie.
That's correct. And not only that, you'd have to have another case that would bring up these same issues.
Professor Johnson, what do you think about just turning your attention to the Supreme Court process, the nomination process? Again, not having a crystal ball, but knowing what you know now, how do you think this will be resolved? Right now, it looks like the Republicans remain strident in their position that they will not even allow Merrick Garland the nomination to get to a hearing. A lot of them are maintaining that they're not going to meet with him. Do you think this will be resolved, or do you think the Republicans will continue to delay this process at least until there is a new president elected?
Wow, that's a tough question. I don't know. Certainly, there is a lot of incentive to stick with what's been said. You know, we won't hold a hearing. If you now hold a hearing, you're going back on that. On the other hand, Merrick Garland is incredibly qualified and fairly centrist. And so I think it's a difficult nomination not to proceed with.
That's Professor Kit Johnson, University of Oklahoma, professor of law. By the way, Buddy Hield fan, I take it, down there in Norman?
Absolutely.
I thought he was going to score 50 against Villanova, I guess. Fell flat.
Disappointing.
Yeah, I know. Well, good luck down the road. We got your blog here, too, lawprofessors.typepad.com/immigration. It's the Immigration Prof blog. Professor Kit Johnson, thank you so much for joining us on WGN.
No, thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Two guests up and one to go. We go to Massachusetts now. Joe Cataldo from Ryan Faenza Cataldo joins us now on Legal Face-Off. There's a case out there in the Massachusetts court system that could effectively make a lot of changes in texting suicide. So we'll bring in Mr. Cataldo. How are you, sir?
Good. I'm doing well. Good morning to all.
All right. Thanks for coming on, Mr. Cataldo. You obviously are representing a pretty high-profile case out in Massachusetts right now involving your client, Michelle Carter. Can you give us a little bit of background on how that case came about?
Sure. I represent Michelle Carter, who was at the time 17 and had a texting relationship with a friend of hers, Conrad Roy, who was 18. And in the course of their texting relationship, he ended up taking his own life, committing suicide, and then the investigation into his phone, if you will, revealed that there was text between the two of them, and ultimately led to the government deciding to file charges against Michelle because they claim that she encouraged him to take his own life and did not dissuade him and caused him to take his own life. And obviously we disagree. It's a suicide. He caused his own death, not she. And in Massachusetts, what makes this particularly problematic is in Massachusetts, there is no statute that outlaws the encouragement or assistance or advising one to commit suicide. So the government here decided to take out a manslaughter charge against Michelle Carter, saying that she actually caused his death, although she was nowhere present, some 30 miles away, just texting him.
All right, and as
a quick overview.
Is Michelle, she was 17 at the time that this allegedly occurred, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So is she being tried as an adult, or does Massachusetts try her as a juvenile?
They are currently trying her as an adult. She was a juvenile, but there's a process in Massachusetts, like many other states, I presume, that allows the government to treat somebody 17 as an adult. That's what they did. They claim that she inflicted the harm upon Conrad Roy. That's the important part, the infliction, because without that, they could not try her as an adult. So they're claiming that she actually inflicted, and that's the key statutory word here, that she actually inflicted the harm upon him. We disagree with that, and that's what the Supreme Court of Massachusetts now has, and they'll be issuing a decision in the next couple of months.
So, Joy, Conrad Roy, the kid who killed himself, he met your client while they were on vacation. and they struck up a friendship mostly through texting, it sounds like. And Roy killed himself in 2014. Some of the texts that we've read included things by Michelle Carter, like saying, just do it already. You think that doesn't qualify under the statute as encouragement of suicide. Why not?
Well, for a few reasons. One, first and foremost, these are just words. It is speech. There's no physical activity. There's no physical action by Michelle Carter. And secondly, you got to take that in the context of their texting relationship. And that is for the months prior to July of 2014, where he took his own life, is she tried to dissuade him. There's many texts. I don't know if you've seen them, but there are plenty of texts in June where she says, you should go to a psychiatric hospital where I went. They're great. And you shouldn't do this. And he tells her, no, I have a plan this time, because he had tried to kill himself previously. This time I'm not going to fail. It's ultimately not until about 2 weeks before he took his own life where she finally endorses his plan. He's convinced her, you should just support me in my decision, because I've already made my decision that I'm going to take my own life. And that's tens, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of text message conversations where he is adamantly telling Michelle, support me, I'm going to kill myself. So she ultimately supports him and gives him encouragement, but that's all it is. It's speech, it's words that if you're going to do it, then, you know, do it. Don't keep living the pain, the life that you're living. At one point, she goes so far as to say that I hope you try it, but fail, then you'll get the necessary help that you need. I think it's also very important to note that in June, he's texting her, let's do a Romeo and Juliet. Those are his words, Romeo and Juliet. And she does respond, and I won't use the exact language, but no, we are not dying. So he's trying to actually convince her at one point to take her own life with him. She rejects that and says, no, we are not dying. But ultimately, she ends up supporting his voluntary decision to take his own life. And so I don't think the causation for a manslaughter that she actually caused him to die is appropriate.
And you feel like this is protected under the First Amendment. You think that prosecutors are trying to criminalize free speech surrounding suicide. There are states, however, that do criminalize encouragement of suicide. Isn't that true?
That is true. And from our research, it's somewhere in the 30s. I think it's maybe 39 or 37 different states have various laws outlawing the encouragement or assistance or advising of suicide to some degree. Massachusetts legislature has not decided to enact such legislation. So we don't have a law that says that's a crime here in Massachusetts. So that's why it's such a reach that for the district attorney's office here to claim a manslaughter. If they want to change the law or enact legislation, they should petition their local state elected officials to change the law, but not to bring a homicide charge against a 17-year-old girl and then try and make it the law retroactive to these facts in this particular case.
You know, Joe, the other states, the other 39-some states that have laws on the books, have you examined them to see if, let's say hypothetically, that your client did say, go ahead, do it. Is that enough in the other states that you've looked at to be prosecuted under those laws? I don't know if you know the answer to that.
I do, to some degree. I do. We have searched some of the other states, as you can imagine, for some guidance here. However, the only one that we really find that's applicable here would be Minnesota. They passed a statute. Their legislature actually enacted a law that says one cannot encourage or advise or assist another in their suicide. So they had a law on the books. And in the case of Melkert Dinkle, a gentleman who then was prosecuted in Minnesota under their statute, Massachusetts doesn't have one, but under their statute, he was convicted. But ultimately, the Minnesota High Court, their Supreme Court, vacated the conviction and sent it back to the trial court, ruling that the encouragement in advising was unconstitutional as violative of the First Amendment. They did leave in place the part of the statute that would say if you assisted in suicide. So I think that we did bring that before our Supreme Court here in Massachusetts and pointed that out to them, how another Supreme Court does bring into the First Amendment this idea when it's only pure speech, you've got to look at the statute and see if your statute is narrowly tailored. And Massachusetts doesn't even have a statute that criminalizes the encouragement of suicide, so no way that can be narrowly tailored. And the Massachusetts prosecutors here are saying, but we have a manslaughter statute, which is common law. And I'm pointing out, well, that clearly isn't narrowly tailored, and they're claiming it is. And I think eventually they will lose. I'm surprised, frankly, that it's gotten this far, but I'm optimistic that our Supreme Court will eventually see it the way we see it and not force it before a jury to be tried.
All right, and from
it's almost like the perfect test case. I hate to say it, but because, you know, when you read the words of your client, I mean, listen, I know she's your client. I know, you know, you feel strongly about it. But just looking at the words that she used, I think that's why this case is getting so much attention. And that's why it's almost the perfect case, because what she said, really, when you look at it, it's hard stuff to accept. Right. I mean, she said, and I have to read it, you know, just for our listeners. She messaged him at 4:19 in the morning. You can't think about it. You just have to do it. You said you were going to do it. Like, I don't get why you aren't. He wrote back, I don't get it either. I don't know. She wrote back. Michelle Carter wrote back. So I guess you are going to do it then. All that for nothing. I'm just confused. Like, you were so ready and determined. He wrote back, I am going to eventually. I really don't know what I'm waiting for, but I have everything lined up. And then your client wrote back, no, you're not, Conrad. Last night was it. You kept pushing it off, and you say you'll do it, but you never do. It's always going to be that way if you don't take action. You're just making it harder on yourself by pushing it off. You just have to do it. So listen, from, I think, you know, a layperson's perspective, it's hard to read those words from a 17-year-old to someone who's on the verge of committing suicide, where she really does seem like she's not just encouraging him, but almost like, you know, pressuring him to kill himself. So I think that's the reason why it's a tough case. Yes, you know, it's a First Amendment case from your perspective, but I think the average person out there reads that and they just think, why wouldn't she go do something? Why wouldn't she get help? Why wouldn't she call someone instead of texting this, you know, this person who's obviously suicidal and encouraging him to do it?
Well, there's a lot of speech that's repugnant to a lot of individuals, but we all know that repugnant speech does not equal a crime, that it is protected under the First Amendment. After all, it is speech. You don't see there where he responds, I'm not talking to you, stop doing this to me, I don't want your support, in hanging up on her or just deleting her from contacting him or blocking her. He's the one, and you read those comments, but you've got to take that into the totality of the circumstances and go back in June and read all those text messages where you'll see she was telling him to get help, but he's telling her, no, I don't want help. I've made a decision. I've tried a year and a half ago to kill myself. I failed, and I'm not living with this pain I live in through every day. I'm going to do it. So a 17-year-old kid finally in a texting relationship is saying, well, you keep telling me you're going to do it, but are you really going to do it? And so she does come to support his plan. He took all the physical activities. As you see, he even said, I lined this all up. He took it. He bought a generator. Generator didn't work. A couple days later, he steals the generator. So he takes all these physical actions to actually take his own life. So I think the government's going to be hard-pressed to say and have our Supreme Court say that she actually caused his death. One of the justices even asked the question to both sides, what power did she have over him? What coercive power? And the answer is there was no coercive power. This was his plan dating back a year and a half. So, you know, it is speech, and it's protected speech. It's the encouragement of suicide. It came down to that at the very end, but it was his plan. And because our legislature has not passed a law saying the encouragement of suicide is a crime, you don't bring it up and notch it up a level to a homicide.
Joe Cataldo representing Michelle Carter against the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The firm is Ryan Faenza Cataldo, attorneys at law, rfclawoffices.com. Joe, thank you so much for your time here on WGN Plus.
Rich, Jason, thank you very much.
And we close out the show, Legal Face-Off WGN Plus, the way we always do, the legal grab bag. And we've got six topics today, some good, some bad, some just downright scary. And we'll start right there in New Orleans, where former Saints defensive end Will Smith was intentionally gunned down by a rageful driver. He was shot seven times in the back and one in the chest. Cardell Hayes was the one who was popped. He's the suspect, and he's the one that's going to go down likely. But, guys, I mean, we can't even get into a regular traffic argument now without being worried about somebody having a gun.
Well, the question is this a regular traffic argument, right? I mean, there's a lot of different interesting legal arguments or facts around this. So, first of all, this case will come down to a couple competing legal theories. Louisiana has the stand your ground law that we heard a lot about in Florida with the Trayvon Martin case, where the law in Louisiana allows a defendant to stand and defend themselves if they have a reasonable, if they're reasonably in fear of imminent serious bodily injury or death. That's what this guy's claiming. This shooter, Cordell Hayes, says that he was the victim, that Will Smith, the former Saint, came you know, after him and was threatening him. They found a loaded gun in Will Smith's car and his Mercedes. Will Smith, his estate, is going to argue that this was a road rage case, that Cordell Jones, or Cordell Hayes, I should say, was the aggressor. He came out of the car and was angry that he was bumped and that he shot Will Smith. So it'll be an interesting trial for sure.
Yeah, and as always, there's more to the story than what the news is talking about. There's video surveillance that showed the G-Wagon that Will Smith was driving bumped the H2 that Cordell was driving, and then there was a chase that ensued, and you know, then, of course, the shooting afterwards. So I'm sure there'll be more to come out of this, and Cordell is claiming self-defense.
How does this get solved, though, Rich, when, I mean, I haven't heard that there's a witness yet, so, and obviously Will Smith's wife is biased, but how does this play out when there, I don't think that there's been a witness come forward yet.
Well, the wife, yeah, the wife's a witness. There's one surveillance video that has an unnamed witness say, so the witness says that he heard this. He says he heard, quote, "Get out of here or I have a gun," period. And he goes, "F y'all, I got one too." And he grabs the gun and then shoots him in the back. He's dead. It sounds like on the tape that Will Smith is the one who initiates the threat with the words, "Get out of here, I have a gun." I mean, it's hard to tell right now who said all that, but that's what's out there right now in the media. Listen, if that's true, it certainly supports the shooter's theory that he was the victim. You know, if and but on the other hand, he shot him in the back, right? How are you defending yourself? If you're the shooter, if you're Hayes, how are you defending yourself if you shot Will Smith in the back? Unless you thought that he was going back to get his gun. But again, does that meet the criteria of stand your ground? Is that an imminent danger? So that's, you know, that's a legal theory that will be played out. For me, the really other interesting part of this that, you know, is not getting a ton of play in the media is the shooter was, so his, you guys probably know this story. His father was shot by New Orleans police, shot and killed. And Cordell Hayes, the shooter in the Will Smith case, sued the police department, got a settlement. And here's where the story gets really strange. One of the police who was involved in the shooter, in the shooting of his father, who was named as a defendant in his lawsuit, in his wrongful death lawsuit, had dinner with Will Smith an hour before this road rage incident. Did you guys hear that part of it?
I hadn't heard that yet, no.
No, I didn't hear that either. I know
right.
That there was some...
So, yeah, I mean, is it a coincidence? So here's how the theory might play out. I mean, again, everyone's denied it. The Cordell Hayes attorney has said that there's no connection. Police have said there's no connection right now. But how is it that in a city the size of New Orleans, which has to be, what, close to a million people, driving around, that the son of a victim of a police shooting hit Will Smith, who had just had dinner with the police officer who shot or was involved in the shooting of his father. I mean, pretty big coincidence that, you know, a lot of people out there are saying was not a coincidence, that's somehow related. So, yeah, really a case chock full of some interesting legal issues.
Attorneys for the man convicted of killing Michael Jordan's father back in 1993 in North Carolina and then dumping his body in South Carolina say they have new evidence to bolster the request for a new trial. They're trying to make him free, Jason, the man who supposedly killed Michael Jordan's father.
Yeah, everyone will remember back in 1993 when James Jordan was killed on the side of the road. The one who's convicted of it, Daniel Green, who's the alleged murderer, his attorneys have long argued that he did help dispose of Jordan's body, but he had nothing to do with the carjacking, and that he blames his friend Larry Demery, who shot and killed Jordan. So they're trying to reopen the case now, even though the handgun that was used, the Smith & Wesson, was found in Daniel Green's vacuum cleaner inside the closet. And there was some other evidence that they found, too. But the attorneys are arguing that there's new evidence now that could point to Daniel Green just being an accessory to the crime, not the actual murderer. So they're hoping that with these new discoveries, they and also with some of the original evidence was mishandled, allegedly, by the prosecutor. So they're hoping that they can get this case reopened and get him on a reduced sentence.
So, Sam, you can give us some perspective because you were, I mean, you were obviously a little younger back in 93, as we all were, but, you know, your early days of following the Bulls. This was 8 days before James Jordan's birthday and was widely cited as a major catalyst for Michael Jordan's first retirement. He decided, the theory goes, to play baseball for the White Sox because it was his father's favorite sport and sort of as a tribute to his dad. So how do you think his, I mean, you know, 20 plus years later, how do you think this murder impacted Jordan's legacy and all that kind of good stuff?
Well, I don't think it affects his legacy, but I know that he's never been one to discuss his father's murder in the open, and I'm sure you guys have heard the old urban legend, and I'm not saying this is true or false, but that, you know, this was over a gambling debt, that Michael
right.
Jordan had run up a lot of bad bills, and this was a way to sort of get even, and then after the fact, Commissioner Stern tried to sweep it under the rug and just told Michael to take some time off, and voila, here he is playing baseball with the White Sox. So there's a lot of murky details. I don't think it affects his legacy, but there's certainly some question marks that I still have to this day.
Yeah, we'll see if this case gets reopened. Pretty interesting stuff.
The affluenza teen, Ethan Couch, back in the news, gets a tentative order for a 2-year jail term.
Yeah, we've talked about the affluenza teen who avoided he ended up killing several people when he was drunk driving his truck, veered over into some stranded motorists who were changing a tire, and killed three, I believe, and then he one of them became a paraplegic in a wheelchair, and Ethan Couch was caught around Christmas time with alcohol, which was violated his probation, and he and his mother fled to Mexico. So the judge gave 180 days for each incident, for a total of 4 incidents, which is over 2 years that he has to serve now as a result of violating that probation. Plus, if he violates it again once he's released, they could re-charge him and resentence him as an adult as opposed to a minor when he was initially charged. So the affluenza teen could potentially, I mean, if he avoids any wrongdoing after he's released after the 2 years, could obviously avoid more jail time. But any further probation violation, and the judge has already declared she's going to throw everything at him.
Yeah, and, you know, a couple takeaways are, number one, this affluenza defense that, you know, attorneys like our friend Jason promulgate are complete nonsense. I mean, to say that you have a psychological problem because you were privileged and that is an excuse for driving drunk and killing 4 people is obviously complete nonsense and junk science. And the other takeaway is probably if you're on parole for killing 4 people, beer pong is probably not a great idea. And ordering pizza when you're hiding out in Mexico is not great. That's how they caught him. He ordered out for pizza when he was hiding out with his mom.
Yeah, wasn't he staying at like a high end resort too? He wasn't staying at like the tiki hut down at the end of the street.
The Motel 3.
Yeah, no, he was at like the Four Seasons penthouse.
Oh, he was at a good one.
Yeah,
Motel 9.
I mean, And his criminal wizardry told him that the best way to disguise yourself is dye your hair. I love when these guys go to Mexico and all they do is dye their hair from like black, you know, to blonde. Like,
but he didn't get rid of.
How are they ever going to find me now that my hair is a different color?
But he didn't get rid of that awful mustache. Like, he's got that prepubescent mustache, and he still did not shave that off. What's interesting they note too is that Ethan's father, Fred, runs a roofing and construction company who has faced several lawsuits over $100,000 in debt and also allegations of sexual harassment. So it doesn't sound like the apple's falling too far from the tree in this one.
So, Rich, we'll go to the hot car death case in Georgia now. Ross Harris, the jury selection began for his trial this week on Wednesday, and already the court's having some problems because a lot of these jurors already have formed an opinion on the hot car death case.
Yeah, this is a case that got a lot of news. We covered it on Legal Face Off in the past. Obviously very sad. This was a 22-month-old boy who was left in a hot car in June of 2014, and prosecutors in Cobb County, Georgia, are prosecuting the father, saying that this was not just negligence, it was purposeful. There was some evidence that he was not happy as a father, and he had looked up different things on the internet about, you know, hot cars and things like that. So pretty tough case. But yeah, to your point, this goes, you know, this talks about one of the issues always with prominent cases, and that is, can you get a jury that's impartial, that's fair? And again, this is often misperceived. The question isn't to a jury whether they have heard of this case in the media before. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find someone on a jury who is not aware of a case like this, or in the O.J. Simpson case, which we covered extensively. You know, it'd be impossible to find someone on that jury who didn't hear of O.J. Simpson. That's not what you want. I mean, the Constitution doesn't say you want, you know, hermits or people who are in a cave somewhere. You want a jury of your peers, and your peers are people who pay attention to the media. So the question isn't whether they've heard of this hot car case. They obviously have. The question is whether they can put aside any preconceived notions of guilt or innocence that might skew their decision making. That's the real question. And listen, this stuff is not a science. People might say, you know, yes, that they can do that when they really have made up their mind. Or they might say that they've made up their mind already just to get out of serving on the jury. So the best you can do as an attorney and as a judge is ask these questions, try to determine whether they've made up their mind beforehand, and roll the dice. But the truth is, when you get 12 people in that box, there are going to be people who have made up their minds, despite the fact that they've said that they won't do that.
Two final topics left on Legal Grab Bag on Legal Face Off, WGN Plus. Jason, Charlie Sheen back in the news. Brooke Mueller is saying that her former man owes her $80,000 in child support.
Charlie Sheen is done winning. He's over with. He's actually claiming now that he can't afford the child support payments that he's supposed to make. And he's supposed to pay Denise, his former wife, $55,000 a month for child support, and the same amount to Brooke. So a total of $110,000, yet he claims his income is only $87,000 a month. So he's saying, you know, since he sold the rights to Two and a Half Men and he's no longer on the show, he can't afford it. Plus, he quotes as saying it costs a lot of money to be an HIV positive person, whatever that means. But he's now Charlie Sheen. I mean, in a legal perspective in the state of Illinois, if you do have a reduction in your income, you can go into court and file for a reduction in your child support payments. But, you know, it opens up all of your finances and they look at, you know, what you have as income assets and whether or not you can really afford it. So Charlie Sheen is capable of doing that and going into court and asking for a reduction in child support. But it exposes his entire financial accounting, too. So we'll see if Charlie Sheen will be reducing that massive $110,000 a month.
But listen, in Charlie Sheen's defense, and maybe, Jason, you could, you know, maybe someone out there can answer better than I can, but it's got to be really expensive to support the amount of porn stars that Charlie Sheen has on his monthly monthly payroll. I mean, that can't be cheap.
Right? I'd have to imagine since he became HIV positive and it went public, the amount of porn stars is reduced drastically, and the partying over at the Charlie Sheen mansion is a little bit lower than it was.
Or you have
pre-HIV.
To pay him more. You have double the money now.
Hey, Court, I can't pay $110,000 for my kids and $100,000 for porn stars and coke.
The escort is tripled. Do you know what I go through?
Yeah. Come on, Judge, have some mercy.
More costs.
We close out the last part of the show here on Legal Face-Off. Dora the Explorer, the voice of Dora the Explorer, has been suspended from high school for vaping.
Hmm. Can we get some sound effects here on the Legal Face-Off?
No, not that. He wants the backpack.
Oh, well, they both work.
I want to hear Sam sing the Dora theme song.
I forgot it. Sorry.
Dora. Anyway, yeah, so this pretty, disturbing blow to all of us who love Dora the Explorer, which I know you guys are part of. Fatima Patacek, who is the teenage actress who voices Dora the Explorer in the animated series, was suspended 3 days for vaping in a high school bathroom. She's 15 years old. She's been Dora since 2011, and she was apparently caught inhaling caramel-flavored water with a classmate back in December. Her friend, who is not Boots, the monkey, but another classmate, was forced to leave the school, and her parents filed a lawsuit against the school. The school is called Avenues. It's in Manhattan. The parents are alleging that there is a discrepancy in punishment, and they're asking for tuition payment and legal fees. So they're saying that their daughter was treated differently from Dora because she's not a celebrity and she's expelled, being used as a scapegoat. So as we always do, we'll cover the latest breaking news in animated lawsuits here on Legal Face-Off.
Get back home safe, will you, Rich? We're worried about you. We're worried that you're not going to be here in 2 weeks. You might be in Bora Bora doing a phoner.
Given the success of our prior absences, we'll continue to explore this as a legal face-off method of communications.
Now, in 2 weeks, Jason will be in Miami, and you'll be in Seattle, and I'll be here. Yeah, and who knows where Watercut will be. We'll figure it out. For Rich, for Jason, I'm Sam. You can always listen to WGNplus.com. Search for Legal Face-Off. We're also on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. We will see you in 2 weeks.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.